Let's jump back to 1 Kings and remind ourselves just as the history that has brought us to the book of Ezra. The book of 1 Kings is the book of disruption. Book of 1 Kings is the book of the Old Testament that records how the nation of Israel divided into two kingdoms, into the northern and southern kingdom. So the outline of the book of 1 Kings is the glory of the United Kingdom and the tragedy of the divided kingdom. 1 Kings broke into two in the middle of the book of 1 Kings. And 2 Kings then, if 1 Kings is the book of disruption, 2 Kings is the book of dispersion, as those two kingdoms were dispersed into foreign captivities. Of course, the northern kingdom was dispersed into Assyrian captivity. The southern kingdom was dispersed into Babylonian captivity. As far as an outline for the book that we learned, 2 Kings has the outline northern kingdom, both kingdoms, southern kingdom, because the first third of the book focuses on the history of the northern kingdom. And then the middle of the book jumps back and forth erratically between the two kingdoms until the northern kingdom goes into Assyrian captivity. And then with it gone, the last third of the book deals with the southern kingdom and ends with the southern kingdom going into Babylonian captivity under Nebuchadnezzar. And so 2 Kings ends with the two kingdoms dispersed into captivity. Then the book of Ezra. The book of Ezra is the book of return. After 70 years of captivity in Babylon, God allowed the Medo-Persian Empire to conquer the Babylonians. The Medo-Persians were not as heavy-handed as the Babylonians with regards to religious worship. They allowed their conquered countries to worship their own gods. And so the Persians were open to Israel going back and rebuilding their temple and worshiping Jehovah. And so under the Persians, they were allowed to return. The book of Ezra records the first two of three returns. We learned that in the dispersion to Babylon, there were three waves of dispersion. Nebuchadnezzar came three times. Finally, the third time, he totally tore down the city of Jerusalem. And so now that the Medo-Persian Empire is allowing a return, there are three returns. And Ezra records the first two of the returns, the return under Zerubbabel, and then the return under Ezra. And then the book of Nehemiah records the final return under Nehemiah. It's the book of rebuilding. And Nehemiah led the people, of course, to rebuild the wall around the city. And so the outline begins with the construction of the walls. And then he spent some valuable time instructing the people. And there's some powerful lessons about God and God's work amongst people there in the middle of Nehemiah, as Nehemiah instructs the people. And then he was an amazing administrator. Nehemiah was a phenomenal administrator. As a matter of fact, oftentimes Nehemiah is taught in colleges as a course on administrative ability and the work of management. And Nehemiah, one of the great books written on the book of Nehemiah was the book by Cyril Barber, which deals with the management skills and the management lessons we learn from the book of Nehemiah. So he consolidated the work with great administrative skills. So Nehemiah, they rebuilt the walls and then he instructed the people and consolidated the work. And that was pretty well the end of the history of the Old Testament. Malachi, the last prophet, and just not too many years before the Old Testament ended, after Nehemiah. However, there's this book of Esther that records for us an amazing story. And Ezra, you know, there are two books in the Bible that are named after women. There's the book of Ruth. Ruth was a Gentile woman who married a Hebrew man. And then there's the book of Esther. Esther was a Hebrew woman who married a Gentile man. So we have two books named by women in the Bible. Ruth emphasized the grace of God. And we saw Ruth as being kind of an oasis of grace in the middle of a horrible time of the judges. And it was a terrible time of Israel being just so far away from God. And the whole story of Naomi is a Moabite woman who met a Israeli family, a Jewish family. Her life story is a story of the grace of God. That God would bring this Moabitess woman into the very genealogy of Jesus Christ. And she would be a part of the genealogical record, family line that brought us Jesus Christ. And a marvelous picture of the grace of God. God's grace goes to everybody. It doesn't matter if you're the son that's licentious or the son that's a legalist or somewhere in between. The two bookends and everything in between. God's grace. God loves everybody and wants to save everybody. Ruth is a great picture of the grace of God. Esther, on the other hand, is a picture of protection. And so the theme of the book of Esther is the protection of God, protecting the nation of Israel. The story of Esther that took place during the time of the returns and it occurred in Shushan the palace over in Medo-Persia. And it's a story about a Jewish woman who had been taken in the captivities, at least her uncle, and I believe her as well. They were taken from Jerusalem to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar's captivities, his dispersions of the people to Babylon. She grew up there, and now she has a story that reflects to us the amazing protective care of God over his people. It was staged right between the two returns, the return under Zerubbabel and the return under Ezra. And God's people in this story are threatened with genocide. There is a concentrated effort to destroy the people of Israel, to annihilate the nation of Israel. And the story of Esther is the story of how God protected the nation of Israel from genocide under the Persian king. And we have three parts to the book of Esther. The outline, the first two chapters, focuses on Esther replacing Vashti. And we'll talk about that in a moment. The second part focuses on Mordecai overcoming Haman. And then the final part of the book, chapters 8 to 10, deals with Israel surviving genocide. And so Esther replaces Vashti, Mordecai overcomes Haman, and Israel survives genocide. The story of Esther is the age-old story of survival for the nation of Israel. It's a story of how a Persian king was manipulated in such a fashion that he decreed that the entire people of the Jewish race, the Jewish people would be annihilated. And so there was this effort to bring a genocide to these people. Let's jump ahead to the next slide that has the history. There's a history behind this. The history behind this is that there was a man by the name of Jacob and a man by the name of Esau. Remember those guys? Jacob and Esau? The struggle in the womb, the birth, the what happened with the birthright? And God choosing Jacob to be the one through whom the messianic lineage would come, Jacob and Esau. Malachi ends the Old Testament by recording, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Jacob and Esau representing two lineages in the Old Testament. One of the descendants of Jacob was a man by the name of Saul. And one of the descendants of Esau was a man by the name of Agag. Saul and Agag. Saul and Agag lived at the same time. You'll remember the story of Saul and Agag from 1 Samuel chapter 15. It was Agag that Saul was commanded to kill him and the entire people group that he represented. The entire Amalekites. They had pushed the limits of God's grace. They had come to the point where they were more danger to the population of the earth than they were of benefit. And it was time for that whole people group to be removed. God delivered the message through Saul or through Samuel to Saul, and Saul went, but Saul did not do what he was told to do, and he did not fulfill the plan of God. Well, Agag and Saul are descendants of Esau and Jacob. But now we come down to Esther's lifetime. Esau's descendant through Jacob's descendant through Saul was a man by the name of Mordecai. And Esau's descendant through Agag was a man by the name of Haman. So in Esther's lifetime, and what played out in the story of Esther, is the age-old struggle between these people groups, Israel and the Amalekites, that goes all the way back to Jacob and Esau, to Saul and Agag, and now with Mordecai and with Haman. We're 500, when we get to Mordecai and Haman, we're 550 years after Agag. 550 years later, and now there's a man by the name of Mordecai, and there's a man by the name of Haman, and these two people groups intersect again. And Satan uses it as an opportunity to try to destroy the descendants of Jacob once again. Behind the actions of Mordecai and the Persian king, behind the actions of Esther and Haman, is the supernatural struggle between God and Satan to destroy Israel, to remove the people of Israel from the face of the earth. And with each event in Esther's story, it looks as if God is going to lose the struggle and Satan is going to win the struggle. And Satan will finally be rid of the people group destined to bring the Messiah, Jesus Christ, into the world. And so here we have this age-old struggle. Now, we need to always remember, though, Psalm 121:4 says, "Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep." He that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. It looks like Satan's got the upper hand. It looks like it's all gloom and doom for Israel, but God's not asleep. And God turns the table in the story of Esther. And the Jews to this day celebrate this story every year. In our calendar, it comes around March, April, May, sometime in there, around the April time frame. Does anybody know the name of the Israeli feast that they celebrate Esther's story every year around April? Anybody remember it? Purim. Purim is the name of the Jewish feast, and it is the most out of control of all of their feasts. As a matter of fact, it almost looks like a kind of a mixture of New Year's and Halloween all mixed together. And they have ruckus parties, and they're required. They are required. If you are above the age of minority, you are required to get drunk. You are required to get so drunk that you can't tell the difference between the names of Haman and Mordecai. And they dress up in costumes. And they give gifts to one another. And they wear funny ears and funny hats. And they make little three-pointed pastries, either filled with chocolate or something. And they eat those in their feast of Purim. And one of the things they do on their Feast of Purim is they read the book of Esther. And in their synagogues and in their meetings, wherever they're gathered together and reading the book of Esther in their two-day Feast of Purim, every time the name Haman is read, everyone begins to say, "Boo! Boo!" And they have noisemakers. They make the noisemakers and they do all they can to drown out the name of Haman so no one will hear the name of Haman. And whenever the name of Mordecai is read, they cheer and it's a big, drunken party to celebrate Israel's surviving the genocide. Now, obviously, the secular, the side of Israel that has no scruples against that kind of thing, but that's what they do. You look up Purim and you read about Purim and watch video clips of it. That's what they do. But it all is rooted in the story of Esther and the attempted genocide. Well, you've got your Bibles open to Esther chapter 1. The Bible tells us that this happened in the days of Ahasuerus. The one who reigned from India to Ethiopia. He was king of everything from India to Ethiopia. Now stop and think. You got the world map in your mind? Everything from India to Ethiopia. That is a massive amount of land. he ruled over all of these provinces. Verse number 2 says, in those days, King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, Shushan the palace, third year of his reign. He made a feast to all the princes and servants. The priest went, feast, the party went verse number 4 says, 104 days. And when the days were expired, they threw another feast, party in all of this. It talks about all of that. And then in verse number 10, on the seventh day of this feast that starts in verse number 4, on the seventh day, the heart of the king was merry with wine. He commanded to bring his wife, Queen Vashti, into the drunken party so all the men could gawk at her. And she said, I'm not going to do that. And of course, this is a heathen king in a drunken party and a drunken stupor. Wants all the men to gawk at his wife, and so they can think wickedness. And she said, it's not happening. I'm not going. And that created an uproar. That created quite an uproar. In fact, all of the men in the palace began to worry that their wives at home would hear that the queen doesn't do what the king says. And that's going to encourage all the wives at home to say to their husbands, we're not doing what you say. Because the queen doesn't do what her husband says. And so they got together and they got to talking about that. And they said, this is not a good thing in the Persian Empire. And so they advised the king. They said, for the sake of all of us guys, you need to make sure your wife is set aside. And just replace her with somebody else. And so he does. He gets rid of his wife. And then he sends word across the Persian Empire to find him the prettiest woman they can find. Well, there was a family that had come to the Persian Empire under the Babylonian captivity. Uncle had taken in his brother's daughter, who was left without mom or dad as a result of the dispersions. And her name was Esther. And he had raised her. He had brought her in and raised her. And somehow, in this appeal to find beautiful women to bring and parade in front of the king, Esther was identified and chosen to be one of those women. Some would think that Esther was a really privileged individual. Yeah, you read the story. She had to soak in a tub of oil for so many months to make sure her skin was soft. Then she had to soak in a tub of perfume for so many months to make sure that when she came before the king, she would be able to delight him in every way he could imagine. This is what has been called the curse of physical beauty. What she ended up being put through as a young Jewish lady was horrible. Because she was beautiful, she ended up being in a place that took away from her the dreams of most young ladies. Being able to have a good marriage, have a family. And all that was taken away. She became an object in a king's household. A play toy for him. And it was a horrible thing. And yet God works through horrible things sometimes. God does amazing things. As a result of her beauty, she ended up being the one of all of the beautiful women that were found. She was the one that was considered to be the one that pleased the king the most. So she replaced the king's wife. And Esther replaced Vashti, and she became the queen. And her uncle Mordecai told her, keep the fact that you are a Jew to yourself. It would be in everyone's best interest for no one to know that you're a Jew. And so she became the king's wife, the queen of the land of Persia. And life went on. Well, one day, because of Esther's position, by the way, that really is a messed up home, the home of the king and the queen. Now we've got the new queen, Esther. And so... as time went on, Mordecai would often find himself at the city gate in a place of prominence, listening to the goings on, because his niece is now the queen. And there at the city gate, he caught wind of a of a couple of guys that were plotting to kill the king. When he heard about the plot to kill the king, he got word to his niece Esther what was happening, gave the names of the individuals. She went to the king and told her husband what Mordecai told her. It was investigated and found out that it was a real plot and they were actually going to kill the king. And so because of Mordecai relaying the message through Esther to the king, they were able to catch them before the plot was played out. They were able to execute the guys and the king's life was spared. Well, time went on. And as time went on, an old feud came up. The king decided that there was a man in his kingdom that he wanted to promote to a very high position, a man by the name of Haman. And so he elevated Haman to a position of great importance in his kingdom. And so Haman becomes a regular in the king's political maneuverings and in the life of the king. And there's this guy, Mordecai. Mordecai, who is the descendant of Jacob, finds himself interacting with Haman, who is the descendant of Esau. And Haman has it out for Mordecai. Now, Mordecai maybe didn't do the smartest thing in the world. When everyone was commanded to bow to Haman, because Haman had been elevated to such a position of authority, and everyone was told to bow to Haman, Mordecai said, "I ain't bowing. It's not happening." And Mordecai refused to bow to Haman. Haman, being a man filled with pride, even though everyone else bowed, the fact that one man wouldn't got his goat. And so he became very angry with Mordecai. And his anger at Mordecai launched a plot, not just to get rid of Mordecai, but Mordecai's a Jew. And we're just going to get rid of all of the Jews in Persia. I'm going to get back at Mordecai by annihilating the entire people group. So he goes to the king. Of course, the king doesn't know that Esther's a Jew. His wife, he didn't know she's a Jew. Haman goes to the king and he tells the king, I think what we need to do for in honor of you and the Persian people, we've got a troublesome group in our empire. We need to get rid of them. And so he ends up convincing the king, and they send out letters and they choose a date. And on a particular date, all over Persia, the peoples in every community and town, they're to round up all of the Jews in their area and they're to execute them. And they're going to kill every Jew in the Persian Empire. Which means Mordecai is going to lose his life. The word went out. Mordecai finds out about it. And Mordecai knows his days are numbered. He's going to be executed with all the other Jews. And so he gets a word with Esther. And he says to Esther, he says, you've got to go to your husband. And you've got to tell him what's happening. And because of the protocol of the king's house, Esther did not have that privilege. She did not have access to the king, even though she was his wife. It was a very structured environment. She could only approach her husband if he called for her. And if he didn't call for her, she could not approach. And if she approached without being called, then she could be executed. Because nobody comes to the king without being invited to come to the king. So she said to her uncle, she said, you're asking me to probably lose my life. And he said to her that phrase that is so popular, so memorized for such a time as this. It may be, Esther, that God allowed you to become the queen for such a time as this. You must risk your life for the sake of your nation. And so she went to the king without being asked. He invited her to come in. He didn't have her killed. He said to his wife, he said, What is it that you want? And she said, I want you and Haman to come to a banquet I prepared for you tomorrow. He said, I can do that. So he took, so the king and Haman both went and became the honored guests at a banquet Esther prepared. And Haman's feeling really good about himself and being a privileged guest in the king's household with the king and his wife. And the king asked her, says, Esther, what is it that you would like? And she said, what I would like is for you to come again tomorrow to another banquet that I prepare for you. I said, okay, I've got to eat tomorrow too, so we'll do that. So they left. That night, the king couldn't sleep. He had a hard time sleeping. And because he couldn't sleep, he had, you know, what do? You count sheep, you pull up a sermon of the pastor's and listen to that because that always works. What do you do? Well, he had some people get out some records of the nation of the country of Persia and just read the records. And so someone's reading him records and reads him about a plot against his life and about a guy by the name of Mordecai that saved his life. The king stopped and said, just a minute. What was done to thank Mordecai for saving my life? He said, well, according to the records, nothing was ever done. Nothing was ever done to show my appreciation of Mordecai for saving my life. Something else that had happened is that Haman had launched a plot to have Mordecai hung on a gallows, and he had a gallows 50 feet high built to have Mordecai hung on. And so anyway, the king says, we need to honor this man. So the next morning, Haman comes in. Haman wants to convince the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he built, having no idea that the king has just been told about Mordecai saving his life. And so the king and Haman sit down, and the king says to Haman, hey, I need some good opinion here. If there was someone that I wanted to honor really highly, and I wanted to show someone how much I appreciate that individual, what would you suggest that I do for a man that the king desires to honor? Well, Haman says, well, I've been promoted to the second most important position in the land. Who in the kingdom would the king want to honor more than me? And so immediately he thinks, wow, I'm writing my own package of promotion. And so he says, well, king, I think that if you wanted to honor a man, I think the way that you could really honor that man is if you take the horse that you ride on and take the garments that you wear and put the apparel on the man and put the man on your horse and have someone lead him around the community saying, honor to this man whom the king sees, wants to honor. And the king says, that's a great idea, Haman, because there's a guy by the name of Mordecai that I want to honor, not knowing that Haman had come to him to convince him to hang Mordecai that very day on his gallows that he had built. And so the king says, I've got a guy that I want to honor. His name is Mordecai, and I want you to have the honor of honoring him. I want you to take my garments and put them on Mordecai. I want you to put Mordecai on my horse. And I want you to lead him through the community saying, honor to Mordecai. This is the man the king wishes to honor. Haman is beside himself. He has no choice. He puts the garments on Mordecai. He puts Mordecai on the horse. He leads him. Haman is totally humiliated. This guy on the horse knows I hate him. This guy on the horse won't bow to me. This guy on the horse, we've got this thing, and he's supposed to be put to death today. And so he rushes home, totally humiliated, and tells his family what happened to him. And about that time, the king says, it's time to go to Esther's house for the banquet. So they go to the banquet, and here's Haman, and here's the king in Esther's home. And Esther, the king says to Esther, what would you like, Esther? You've invited me 2 days in a row. What is it you want? She said, I want you to understand that there is a plot launched to have me and my people put to death. What? The king says, who would do such a thing? She said, that wicked Haman did it. The king looks at Haman. The king goes into a rage. The king leaves the room and he's pacing back and forth, angry at what he has just discovered, walks back into the room, and there is Haman. He has fallen down on the couch, the bed, the chair, the whatever that the queen was sitting on. He falls down begging for his life. The king walks in and says, will he force the king's wife also? And someone says, hey, there's a gallows outside. He said, hang him. And so Haman's taken outside and hanged on the gallows that he had built the day before with the intention of hanging Mordecai. And as a result of the happenings that day, Haman is dead and Mordecai is elevated to the position of Haman, a position of honor, and Mordecai and Esther appeal to the king with regards to the signed document for the king that went through the entire empire in which all of the Jews are supposed to be annihilated on a date coming up. And the king reverses all of that and Israel is saved. And the book of Esther ends by talking about a feast of Purim. The word Purim comes from the word pur, which means lots, the casting of lots. Apparently there was something with the casting of lots, I think, on to decide what day the Jews were all supposed to be put to death. And God said to the Jewish people at the end of the book of Esther that from here on, you're to, every year, on this particular day, 2 days, you're to celebrate the reversal of the genocide attempt. And so for all of these thousands of years, the Jewish people every year, they have their feast and they pause and reflect that even the attempt that looked like it was going to happen to bring genocide to the nation of Israel fails, because God is a God who never slumbers nor sleeps. He watches over the nation of Israel. And to this day, the Jewish people celebrate that at the Feast of Purim. So Esther, a beautiful picture of the protection of God, and all through the Holocaust. And there's some interesting stories about Jews celebrating Purim during the Holocaust and after the Holocaust, all through the horrible history of the nation of Israel. The Feast of Purim has always been their expression that God protects us in the face of insurmountable odds. And when it looks like there's no chance for us to survive, God pulls it out at the last minute and we don't. We're not annihilated as Hitler tried and as the Antichrist one day will try during the tribulation period. Esther, the story of God's protection of the nation of Israel.